Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Selling Greenville, your favorite real estate podcast here in Greenville, South Carolina. I'm your host, as always, Stan McCune, realtor, right here in the Greenville area of South Carolina. You can find all of my contact information in the show notes if you need to reach out to me for any of your real estate needs. And just a reminder, as always, please silence your phones, as I just had to do because I forgot to. Silence your phones so you don't miss what I'm about to say. Please also subscribe to the show so you don't miss future episodes if you enjoy it. Leave a rating, leave a review. I'd appreciate any of you guys that do that. And if you need a realtor in the Greenville area, you can find all of my contact information in the show notes. That is the housekeeping for today. I've got a lot to talk to you guys about because there's a lot of different things going on here. The government is cooking a lot of different things. I just came back from D.C., what we call the Realtor Legislative Meetings. This is basically a time for realtors to converge. I think there were 10,000 of us on Washington, D.C., kind of take over the city, talk about homeownership-related issues, realtor-related issues with government officials and amongst ourselves. We also talked about the National Association of Realtors Commission settlements. So we're going to be talking about that in this episode. I'm also going to be talking about some changes that are going to be made to wholesaling on the state level in South Carolina. And then we're going to be talking about elections and candidates that are running for local and state office. I'm not going to be talking about specific candidates, but talking high level on some of this stuff. So stay tuned if you're interested. A lot of people tell me that they enjoy my content when I talk about politics because there's not a whole lot of people talking about local politics. I have to be more careful now than in the past because now I'm privy to some confidential information, whereas in the past I was simply able to speculate without any potential concern for repercussions. I can't do that anymore, but I do have some good content for you guys, so please listen to the entire episode. But we're going to start off with the DCRLM. Of course, they've got to make everything into an acronym. Realtor Legislative Meetings. Some people call it the mid-year. That's a common thing that I learned amongst realtors. But I went to DC last week. It was a really, really good time for this conference. And it was about all things national real estate and how real estate interplays with the federal government. So we have these big sessions with the whole group and then smaller breakout sessions. There was an expo. There was receptions for city, region, and state groups. So I literally had three different receptions, a Greenville one, a Region 4 reception, and a State of South Carolina reception. And then we also had meetings with actual legislators at Capitol Hill. So that was fun. But in general, I just want to talk about more high level to start here. It was kind of a somber mood at this conference, and this kind of permeated it in a few different ways. There's just a lot of uncertainty right now about the future of real estate, the future of our government as well, because obviously it's a big election year. A lot of people don't know what's going to happen these next few months, and you just kind of got the sense that things were just a little bit more somber than you would typically expect. Now, this was my first time at this conference, so I can't speak to how it compared, but in one breakout session I was in, there were panelists, and they were taking Q&A, and they said that there were way fewer questions, and the group was way less chatty than normal during Q&A, so that leads me to believe that it was a more somber time in general than typical. So I found that to be very interesting. A lot of this conference, in terms of the sessions, were alternating between the National Association of Realtors settlement over commissions, as well as artificial intelligence. So I've joked with some people that we kind of alternated constantly between saying the word settlement and AI over and over and over again. In general, I will say there were some helpful things that came out of it with regard to the NAR settlement. For those of you interested in that, I've talked about this before, so I'm not going to go into a lot of details about it. They're still very much in a state of, we're not sure. We've got more information, but we're still not sure what's going on. That being said, There is still getting to be some clarity. So here's an example of where like clarity is still needed. Right now, by the way, the settlement originally, the changes were as a result of the settlement were going to be in July. Now that's gotten pushed back to mid-August. I do believe, based on the fact that things are starting to move along in terms of approval process for the settlement, I do believe that mid-August date, I believe it's August 17 of this year, when the big changes are going to be made, I do believe that is going to hold, just based on what I'm seeing. But an example of a something that still needs clarity is that this settlement, part of what was mandated in the settlement, is that for a buyer agent to give a tour to a home to a potential buyer, that they must have a signed agreement, a buyer agency agreement with that buyer. Well, the question comes up, well, what about open houses? Open houses are done on behalf of the seller, even though you are kind of showing tours to buyers. It's different. That doesn't require any paperwork signed by the buyer for you to do that. Okay, great. Well, what if that buyer decides to make an offer? Well, this is where it really gets to be a gray area, because they say that you can perform ministerial acts on behalf of the public without them having a buyer agency agreement in place per se. But at one session I was at, they said, well, if you're at an open house, a buyer comes through, it's fine for you to show it to them. But if they want to make an offer, then you have to have them sign a written agreement. Well, that is very much against what the industry has always been about, because that isn't your client, right? If I'm representing a seller and someone shows up at the house, they want to look at the house during an open house, I'm not representing them. I have not represented them at any point during the process, and I shouldn't represent them, right? Because representation implies that you've been working with this person up to this point. And we have in South Carolina something called transaction brokerage that allows realtors to do ministerial acts and other things on behalf of parties that they don't represent. And so this came up in session, and the panelists were just kind of like, yeah, we need to get back with you on that. I don't know if they've updated yet their FAQ to account for that. I haven't had a chance to look at it, but those are the sorts of things that are still being figured out, still being worked out. Obviously, a lot of attorneys are working through the legalese and trying to nail things down. But that's kind of what's going on there. Now, with regard to meetings with legislators, we had a lot of great meetings. I personally met with William Timmons, with Jim Clyburn, with Ralph Duncan, with Congressman Norman. Went to a reception where Nancy Mace was there and Lindsey Graham and a few others. So there were a lot of different things where we got to meet with legislators and tell them what we thought was going on in the industry. And we would actually bring them a printout of, here are our top issues and here's statistics that talk about these issues and kind of what we're seeing, boots on the ground. And again, you might think that this is all just about realtor stuff. No, a lot of this is about homeownership and affordable housing kind of things, because at the end of the day, those are the things that impact our business. We're not asking for the government to pay us, right? Unlike so many businesses. I mean, I saw people being on strike trying to get the government to do all sorts of things for them in order to correct their pay. Realtors aren't asking for that. Realtors are just asking for the government to not stonewall the real estate industry as it pertains to home buyers and sellers. Well, it was interesting talking to some of these legislators that they actually do kind of have an idea of what's going on, and that's because they are impacted by these higher mortgage rates. Multiple of these legislators that we spoke to told us that the past couple of years, have either been looking for a house or decided to purchase a house or decided not to purchase a house and were impacted by mortgage rates. And I found that to be really fascinating. That was great intel for me personally that, okay, our legislators understand the high rates are impacting people because they're impacting our legislators. Now we just need to get them to understand some of the other pieces of the equation and some of the things that they can do. They can't impact rates, obviously. That's something that is, at least for the time being, outside of their control, because the Fed, nonpartisan group, nonpartisan organization, at least for now, right? And so the Fed controls essentially what happens in mortgage rates indirectly, or directly, depending on how you look at it. But our legislators are aware that that housing affordability is really, really bad. Now, some of them have solutions I agree with, some of them have solutions I don't agree with, and some of them have no solutions at all. They just have guesses. And there was one person that we spoke to, I won't mention this person's name, but this person, not even going to say if it was a he or she, this person said a few things that clearly they did not, they had a superficial understanding of our issues. So I was able to pick up very quick on whether the people we were talking to seemed to have a grasp of real estate related issues, or whether they were just kind of, you know, being political and just kind of BSing us. Definitely ran into that as well. But those meetings went really, really well. It was cool to get in there. We actually had to wait outside the Capitol for a while because the president was actually giving a speech, and then we got into the Capitol. One of the Senate buildings, I can't remember exactly which building we ended up getting into, because we ended up going in a back way because William Timmons got us in. That was kind of interesting. Then we got on the steps of the Capitol, and from there we got to, see the presidential, motorcade go by. And so, that was all very interesting. And I enjoyed my time in DC. I'm glad that I got to go there and experience all that. And it's a yearly thing, so hopefully I will get to go in future years as well. But let's talk about the state of South Carolina more so than the federal government and what's going on there. We've had some changes in the state of South Carolina that have happened within the past week. And I've talked about some of this in the past. But there's one thing in particular I'm going to discuss here, and that is that South Carolina finally passed a law that now goes to the governor's desk. He may have signed it by the time this recording is published, I'm not sure. But among other things, this law says that in order to do real estate wholesaling in South Carolina, you must be a real estate agent, a licensed real estate agent or broker in the state of South Carolina. Okay, provision number one, to wholesale, you must be a realtor. And then provision number two, I'm kind of oversimplifying how this law is worded because it's not that way. But a simple way to think about it is that then provision number two, it says real estate agents can't participate in wholesaling. Technically, we've not really been able to participate in wholesaling in a very long time, but they've had to clarify some of these things. Now, a reminder for those who don't know, what is wholesaling? Wholesaling is a way to sell real estate. A simple way of thinking about this is how you can sell real estate without being a realtor. So you can get a home under contract for $100,000 and then find someone that's willing to buy it for $120,000 before you even purchase it. And then what happens is you go to the closing table with all three parties. And of course, a lot of wholesalers will do this to where it's not all three parties at the table together, but it can be done that way. And the end seller gets $100,000, the end buyer pays $120,000, and then the wholesaler gets the what's in between those two numbers, the $20,000, which is then their assignment fee, is the term that's frequently used. And so that is, very loosely speaking, how wholesaling works. Now, in case my wholesaler friends are listening, I do have some of them. I am not against wholesalers, and if you are one of my wholesaler friends, you know that. But I am against predatory wholesaling, and that is ultimately what this bill is trying to curtail and is trying to protect the public from predators. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to do that without impacting all of wholesaling. And I'd love if any of my wholesaler friends could give me ideas for how we could impact the wholesaling predators without impacting the people doing it well and doing wholesaling ethically. Anyway, let's just ask the question, right, that wholesalers have on their mind right now, and that is, will this ban wholesaling in the state? Will this actually, it is a ban, will it actually work? Now, let's just say that word in the wholesaler community got around rather quickly after this passed. And generally speaking, I think most wholesalers think it's a big nothing burger. They're already figuring out loopholes and ways of getting around the rule, because importantly, the bill doesn't ban contract assignments due to those being necessary in other aspects of real estate, such as commercial real estate, 1031 exchanges, and the like. That being said, there are really two main concerns that I have about this bill and how I don't think it will impact predatory wholesaling. First off, the bill, which I'm not going to get into a lot of specifics about it. We're just going to talk high level here. It essentially bans wholesaling by stating you can't advertise real estate with the expectation of compensation unless you have a written listing agreement, right, that specifies what your compensation is. I don't know if that really does the job, because wholesalers, A, they can still do double closings, right? And in a double closing, you purchase it and then you immediately sell the home to someone else, the end buyer. And you can claim perhaps that the end buyer is a business partner. I mean, there's a lot of different ways that this can be done. Even if a wholesaler doesn't go about it that way, you know, defining advertising real estate, to me, that's going to be tricky. I feel like there are going to be loopholes there. And the bill also differentiates between advertising real estate, which can only be done with a listing agreement, and advertising a contractual position in a sales agreement. Now, I'm no attorney, and nothing in here is legal advice. Nothing on this podcast at all up to this point or after this point is going to be legal advice. So get an attorney if you need that, if you need legal advice. But I have a hunch that little differentiation is going to be a big moneymaker. The differentiation between advertising real estate versus advertising a contractual position in a sales agreement, that little differentiation between those two things is going to be a big moneymaker for some lawyers involved in wholesaling. I have a feeling that there's going to be some lawyers that figure out a way to weaponize that language and use it in order to make themselves some money. The attorneys have been making all the money in all of this, and I think that that's going to keep going. And really, at the end of the day, the closing attorneys are the ones who hold all the keys when it comes to wholesaling. In my opinion, they enable predatory practices when they keep assignment fees off of seller settlement statements. So standard practice is that the buyer and seller in a standard real estate transaction, the buyer and seller both sign the same settlement statement. If you've ever bought or sold real estate, you have signed a settlement statement, and likely the other party's signatures are on there as well. And that shows how much money the buyer is paying and how much money the seller is receiving. And that's a legally binding document. Now, law firms that specialize in helping wholesalers will give different settlement statements to the seller, where they hide how much money the wholesaler is making in their assignment fee. And then the buyer will get a different settlement statement that does have that number on it. Now, does that sound fishy? Does that sound predatory? Well, if you're a wholesaler, you probably think, no, that's not predatory. That's just a way to make sure that we don't have closing table confusion. Let me ask you, if you're not doing something predatory, why do you need to hide how much money you're making? Me as a realtor, I have to have the conversation of my compensation upfront with my clients right away. And I feel like a lot of these wholesalers, if they're not predatory, but they're not willing to have how much money that they're making be shown to the seller, it's because they're not good at explaining their value as a wholesaler to the seller, right? Us as agents, we have to explain our value to our clients. If you're a wholesaler and you're scared about the seller finding out how much money you made on a wholesale deal, then your explanation's not very good. I'm sorry. That's how I feel. And I've never had a wholesaler give me a good answer to the question of if you're not doing something predatory, then why do you need to hide how much money you're making? If you explain to the seller that you're going to make money doing this, assigning the contract to someone else, then what's the big deal? Did you not explain to them that you might make a lot of money? You might make $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000. I don't know what wholesalers are doing. I used to do wholesaling before I was a realtor, and I would always explain that to the people that I was wholesaling. I never had anyone give me pushback on that. They understood it, and they knew how much money I made at the end of the day when it all worked out, and that was that. Nobody gave me pushback. So my concern is that the ones who prey on others in real estate will find loopholes, and closing attorneys will enable those predatory practices by letting them exploit these loopholes and then hiding the assignment fees on those settlement statements. That was all one concern I have. Another concern I have is, who's going to police this? Like, is this going to be on agents to police wholesalers? I feel like that's an additional burden. Like, are we going to have to be giving statements and providing proof? Nope, no realtor is going to do that. Let me tell you that right now. No realtor is going to police this. And so who's going to police it? Is the real estate commission going to police it? Are brokers going to police it? Are the Association of Realtors, the local, the state, the National Association, are they going to police it? I don't know who's going to police this. And so, and that's a whole separate thing that's just kind of like, okay, if nobody's going to police it, yeah, you might say it's illegal, but what are the ramifications for this being illegal? And a separate question I have is, will this impact realtors who do deals with wholesalers, right? There's some pretty vague language in this bill that says that realtors can't assist others in the practice of wholesaling. Well, what does assisting entail? If I answer a question someone asks me about real estate and then later find out that they use that information that they gathered from me to do a wholesale deal, did I assist them? If I answer a question on a Facebook group to a wholesaler, did I assist them? As a realtor, I'm very concerned about the language being used here. What if I have a client that wants to buy a deal off of a wholesaler and they want to use an agent to help them with that? Do I have to say, tough luck, you're on your own, deal with the predatory wholesaler because I can't help you because that's assisting the wholesaler? I don't know. It doesn't seem that way to me, but that language, assisting in the practice of wholesaling, I really don't like it, and I've expressed it to people that I don't like it. Unfortunately, it still snuck its way in there, and we'll see what happens now. Okay, moving right along, let's talk about the elections. We have primary elections coming up very soon. Actually, early voting is, oh boy, early voting. I have it on my calendar because I'll be out of town for the normal voting. Early voting is May 28th through 31st. And then, I believe, election day proper is the next week. I'm not going to say what day it is because I don't want to steer you wrong, but look it up if you're a South Carolina voter or a non-South Carolina voter as well. But we have primary elections coming up really soon, just a few weeks, with many county council, state house, state senate races, not a ton of things in the upstate that are going to be city related. We already had, a lot of that earlier this year. So this is going to be mostly county, state house, and state senate. Now, most of the primary races are Republican races because, well, Greenville is a heavily Republican area for the most part. And I'll mention this, in case you're the type of person that's inclined to wait to vote until a general election rather than a primary election, a lot of these races are going to be decided in the primaries because a lot of these are a one-party race, usually Republican, but there are some Democratic. There are some county council and some other seats that are up for election right now, where it's basically only Democrats running as well. And in those instances, when it's only one party that's running, the primary decides who wins. And we've had some of these races decided by fewer than 10 votes in the past. So it's really important that you guys go out to vote for these primary races. I'm very passionate about that, as you can probably tell. So please, please, please go out to vote in a few weeks and make your voice heard. I don't even care who you vote for. We just need to see people participate in democracy. So all that to be said, Greenville is obviously a very heavily Republican area. That's no surprise to everyone, to anyone. And so obviously a lot of these primaries are Republican parties. Are the Republican Party dominating the primary or the only party in that specific primary? Well, you may or may not know that the Republican Party in South Carolina, and this is true of the whole country, but it's definitely true in South Carolina, is more split than I can ever remember. And a very clear theme is emerging. where we have the so-called Freedom Caucus Republicans, which are kind of a spiritual successor to the Tea Party of yesteryear. They're not quite MAGA. They're not quite libertarian. They're kind of something in between all of that. But predominantly, they're just very socially conservative. They're very focused on gun rights, the pro-life movement, library books, things of that nature. So you have those Republicans, and then you have the more moderate Republicans who are campaigning on issues like budget reform, infrastructure, functional government, etc., etc. Now, I'm not going to make any endorsements on this show. As I've already said, I'm now privy to far too much confidential information that could get me in trouble if I reveal it on here. But I think you need to strongly consider. I'm going to encourage you to strongly consider which side you vote for. If you're voting for Republicans, if you're going to vote for the Freedom Caucus members, or if you're going to vote for the more moderates. I'm not going to tell you which one to vote for, but I am going to say, if you're on the Freedom Caucus side and more focused on social issues, that's totally fine, but I would encourage you to look into the voting records of those running for that group or that claim to be a part of the Freedom Caucus or have shared values with the Freedom Caucus to see what they've done in recent years. And as you can probably sense, I have some concerns with the Freedom Caucus and their approach. And I'll say that in general, I'm troubled because I have seen situations where our state legislature in particular could not even get a motion to adjourn passed because there was so much dysfunction and infighting in the state house, specifically among Republicans. Like it or not, compromise is necessary in government, and those running on platforms that are saying that they won't compromise are either lying or essentially admitting that they will contribute to dysfunction. That's what I keep hearing. People saying, well, I'm not going to compromise, blah, 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 blah. And when I hear that, that's some great red meat for certain people. When I hear that, I hear this is a person that doesn't understand retail politics. Because the reality of the fact is democracy only works in compromise. If you know anything about history, you know that. The Constitution that we have today was the result of intense compromise between parties. And that compromise created something, not perfect, but something that served our country really, really well. And had we veered off in either direction from where that compromise went, it might not have turned out the way it did in our country. Now, you might be a cynic and saying our Constitution isn't good and our country's not good. Whatever, I'm not going to argue with you on that. I'm just saying compromise in government is necessary because you're never going to get a bunch of people to agree on every single point. And if someone says they're not going to compromise, that's a big, big red flag for me. And a lot of these people that I'm concerned about are either saying that directly or implying it. But more to the point, when we have crumbling roads, people trying to raise the price of real estate by stonewalling development, people in the state and county intentionally allowing certain builders to do certain things because that helps them out, helps out their campaign, helps out their district. It does bother me when someone comes along and thinks it's a bigger deal that we make a symbolic social gesture, like saying that Greenville County is a Second Amendment sanctuary or a right-to-life county or whatever buzzwords you can think of that isn't anything more than red meat to the base. That bothers me. It's not even meat. It's fluff because those are meaningless distinctions that are not decided by the county. Literally, the county does not have jurisdiction in these sorts of social issues. Those are state level or federal level issues. To me, I prefer it to be on the state level, right? I've always been a proponent of states' rights. That is something, and that's the kind of conservative that I am. And I do identify as, generally speaking, most people would consider me to be a conservative. But we've got to stop government overreach, and we've got people that want to weaponize Greenville County Council to overreach and to step into state issues, even if they're just being symbolic, and a lot of this is just symbolism. Well, guess what? I don't pay taxes and vote for people in county council to do symbolic gestures. I just don't. And I don't think our issues lie in a lack of social conservatism anyway, right? South Carolina, listen, if you think South Carolina isn't socially conservative enough, then I don't know what state to tell you to move to, right? Maybe Florida? I don't know. Florida's pretty, has a diversity of political views in that state. So I'm not even sure if you'll find what you're looking for there. Texas? I don't think you'll find what you're looking for in Texas either. So I don't take it seriously when someone is really focused on, they think that South Carolina, that the big problem is social issues. To me, that's not a serious person. That's not someone that has really dug into the actual issues facing South Carolinians, in my opinion. And yes, I'm going on a rant here. Absolutely. That I feel like I'm entitled to a rant every now and then. And I'll mention as well, the social conservatives in our government have caved over and over again to other things that aren't traditionally conservative, such as added taxes on gasoline, sales, added taxes on development, etc., etc. And so they claim to be conservative, but they don't. They're only conservative on a few very specific things, and those things happen to be social issues, but then you're not conservative about the issues that are actually part of what your part of the government are supposed to be addressing. That, to me, seems like a double standard, particularly on the county level. What about the state level? I thought conservatives were for lowering government involvement. So increasing government involvement in social issues is a concern for me as well, because if the government flips to people with a social agenda I don't like, I don't want them to have the power to ram a bunch of stuff through the state legislature, because we've gifted them all of this power over our society, over the social aspects of our area. We don't want, in my opinion, we don't want the government to have its fingers over everything that's happening in our society. And so I don't even like the government being super involved in social issues. Me personally, I know there are going to be listeners that are going to disagree with me on that. And that's fine. We can agree to disagree. But you need to seriously consider whether the people who are claiming to be conservative, whether that conservatism is robust or narrow, because a lot of the conservatives running in the state and county right now are what I would call narrow conservatives. They are single or two issue conservatives, and you that's just not what being a conservative is, in my opinion. Okay, now I apologize if you're listening and you're not a conservative, but the reality is that if you're listening to this and you're not a conservative, that probably means that you're interested in investing in South Carolina real estate from outside of the state. And you need to understand that South Carolina is a very conservative state, okay? You need to understand. It's good for you to hear this stuff. So I'll just throw that out there as well. And again, this is not an endorsement or lack thereof of an endorsement to anyone. And I'm not saying I won't vote for someone just because they affiliate with the Freedom Caucus or hold to certain social conservative views or anything like that. I'm not drawing that kind of line in the sand at this point. But I have concerns with the approach of people that make these social issues the dominant thing and will not compromise and are inconsistent within their own viewpoints. All right, that's all I'm going to say about that specific thing with the elections. Let's talk about candidates for a second. I'm not going to name names, but I'll say this. Everybody who isn't an incumbent is winging it. And that's pretty normal, okay? I think people don't fully understand that those running for state and local government have no idea what they're doing. Like, there's very, very few people who have genuine experience that crosses over into the political world who's running for state and local office. And that's totally fine. And even those who do have that experience from commissions or whatever whatever they might have that experience from, they are still really, really green. I've talked to a lot of these candidates, super duper green. They're still figuring out the issues. They're still figuring out where they even stand on the issues. You've got to know the issues first before you can figure out where you stand on them. They're trying to listen to their constituents and formulate their own opinions based on that. So there's Just understand that. Understand that these people that are running, they don't know what they're doing. Will they figure it out? I hope. We've had a bad history of people running for government and winning elections that never learn and never figure it out. But I'm hopeful. We've got some smart people running for office this year And I'm actually excited about that. I'm excited about several people running for county council, for state house, for state senate. And I think that that's going to be, I think it's going to be great. But just understand from the outset, most of these people are very, very green. Now, I've spoken with many of these state and local candidates about homeownership, housing affordability, etc. Very few of them truly understand the borderline apocalyptic scenario we could experience 15 to 20 years from now if we stonewall builders the way many are demanding the government do. There's very much a we need to stop development now and figure that out later sentiment in Greenville and in the state of South Carolina. But remember, demand gets pent up every year, right? Every year that we have less development than we have people moving into the area, demand gets pent up. The dam, the water keeps building in the dam and eventually has to be, that dam eventually gets broken. At the very least, the water eventually starts to trickle over. And eventually, even if the dam holds up, the water flows over and causes issues that way as well. But every year, development is at record lows in this area. And despite what people tell you, it is at record lows in the upstate, I'm telling you. But demand continues to grow. And with growing demand comes growing prices. That is just the reality of the situation. If supply doesn't keep up with demand, prices go up. And currently, the average first-time home buyer is 35 to 36 years old. If home prices continue to outpace inflation, which they will, if we don't build more, we could see our children needing to be in their 40s, basically, before they can afford a home without parental assistance. That's the reality of where we're at. And that's why I call it a borderline apocalyptic situation. That's not healthy for our economy. That's not healthy for our children, for the next generation. And so why is development being stonewalled? Well, there's two primary reasons that I hear most frequently. One is that people don't like the way tract-built communities look, understandably. And number two, they're concerned about roads not being fixed. Talk about the tract belt communities for just a second. I actually agree with this concern to a certain extent. What has been shown is that actually more high-end housing does have a trickle-down effect to the cheaper communities. So right now, what a lot of these, you know, developers are doing is they're trying to find a middle class, a cheap middle class product that they can sell. And maybe Greenville is maybe we are tapped out development wise in that specific thing. If I'm willing to concede something, it is that maybe we need to move to kind of forgetting about trying to build new housing for that, you know, lower middle class to middle class demographic, and focus on the much cheaper, affordable workforce housing, whatever you want to call it, end of the spectrum, where you've got like people that can get housing at 60% or 55% area median income, that type of thing. That would be government subsidized housing, which some may agree with, some may not. I'm just throwing options out there. On the other end of the spectrum, we need more communities that are really, really nice, like $750,000 plus communities. Here's what happens with those communities. People step up into those communities. So someone that's currently in a $500,000 home, they're looking for something nicer, and they're looking for that $800,000, $900,000 home. Well, not a whole lot of those exist. So what happens when you get homes like that built, the person moves out of the $500,000 home and then buys that home? Well, then who buys the $500,000 home? It's someone that's currently living in a $300,000 home. They step up and they purchase that $500,000 home. Well, then what happens to the $300,000 home? Now that becomes available to the person that's stepping up from a cheaper home, or to the person that perhaps is currently renting. And so there is, and I'm not just making this up. This isn't just theoretical. There is a ton of data. I can throw data at you guys all day if I really want to, that shows that this dynamic happens. It even happens with apartments. And this is the part, there was a whole study done recently in San Francisco about this, that building apartments, high-end apartments, luxury apartments, causes the cost of housing to go down for everyone else in the business. This is why I like to say all housing is affordable housing. People like to pigeonhole affordable housing to one specific thing. But no, all housing is, by definition, affordable housing because all housing that is built makes the market more affordable at all price points. But Greenville is tired of these production-built tract communities. I get it. I totally get that. And so maybe it is time that we start to try to attract more luxury housing, higher-end sort of communities to give people a way to step up. I mean, look at how successful Hartness has been, right? Hartness has been wildly successful. Other communities similar to that. That was, communities built originally with the idea of being higher end communities, and people love those communities and they've had no problem selling out. That is the sort of thing that I think we need to be maybe more focused on in this area. Now let's talk about the second thing that I mentioned, development. Why is development being just as a whole stonewalled? That wasn't the second thing. That was the question. The second thing was the roads not being fixed. Now, there will be a penny sales tax on the ballot this year, basically allowing voters to vote on whether they would approve a 1% sales tax increase, which, by the way, that won't. There are some certain things that will not be taxed as part of this tax, including groceries. We don't want to harm, obviously, those on the lower income end of the spectrum. They have to buy groceries. That's not a luxury item. That will be excluded from the sales tax. But this 1% sales tax, or the penny tax, as they're calling it, to make it sound even less than 1%, it's going to be on there in order to fund roads. And this is really, really important, all right? If you're a cynic, if you're just like, yeah, they're not going to use it to fund roads. They tried that with the gas tax. They messed up with the gas tax a few years ago. This time, they're going to put on the ballot the exact roads to be improved by this tax. And they already have the debate. There were people that wanted there to be more stuff paid for besides just roads on the penny sales tax. And thank goodness the committee, they held their ground. They said this can only be for roads. So it's only going to be for roads. And they're going to put the exact roads that it's going to be for on the ballot. Now, they're still figuring out how they're going to squeeze all of that into a ballot. So we'll see how it plays out. Obviously, you can't have people reading 20 pages while they're voting. So we'll see how all that plays out. But we got this penny sales tax. And the penny sales tax is very divisive. All right. And here's what we're seeing, right? The candidates I've talked to, they have to really walk a fine line here because I think they realize that this tax, unfortunately, is necessary. But as I've already said, I've already called out some of them for flip-flopping on conservative values. And a lot of them are wrestling with, they don't really want to be positive about the penny sales tax. They want to run on a fiscal responsibility platform. But a lot of them realize they kind of have to, like, we kind of need this more tax revenue. And that might come as a surprise. If you know me well, you know I am not a big tax guy. I am a small government person, generally speaking. You probably figured that out from some of the comments I've made. But this is a different scenario. And I'm going to try to convince you guys real quick on my perspective on this. So the long story short is, if you want the roads to be fixed, you have to be in favor of the penny sales tax. I'm sorry, I'm not a fan of these taxes, but we've dug too deep a hole. No pun intended. No, I'm not going to make a pothole joke. But we have dug too deep a hole when it comes to the roads things. And I've heard candidates say, we don't need to raise taxes. We just need for the government to be more efficient with the money that the county and state already has. I'm sorry, but people have been saying this for at least a decade now, and it's time to realize that even if we had the money, and I actually don't believe that we do, because it's a multi-billion dollar problem. Hope you guys like that. I never talk like that into my mic. Multi-billion dollar problem just in Greenville County alone. Billions of dollars are needed to fix these roads. It's been studied, it's been assessed, it's been quoted. It will be billions of dollars, okay? Finding ways of completely restructuring the way tax money is spent on the county or state level is far too ambitious of a project for a newbie on county council or in the state house to tackle. They're not going to be able to somehow find a way to completely restructure county or state budgets in order to come up with $2 or $3 billion. It's not going to happen. I'm sorry. It's a pipe dream. You can say that you're going to do it. You're not going to do it. Come back to me 2 years from now and show me that you did it. You're not going to be able to show it to me. I promise you. I challenge you. And hey, if you do find a way to do that, I will forever support your campaign. And I will bring you more support than you could ever have guessed. Because I've got connections. I've got ways to get you money. But guess what? You're not going to be able to do it. Because the money isn't there. And similar to the development concern that I've already mentioned, where every year we're digging a deeper hole and things are getting more expensive for the future generations. Similarly, every year we don't fix the roads, they get worse, and then fixing them becomes more expensive, and then there are more roads to fix. So this becomes a compounding problem, and a problem that gets more expensive every year. And people don't like when governments get into debt and run a deficit. I certainly don't. But these roads are a deficit. These roads are similar to if our government was running this huge fiscal deficit and had a huge budget shortfall and was taking on tons of debt. Not fixing these roads creates more of a road deficit in a similar way to creating a budget deficit that has a bunch of debt. And not fixing them is going to hurt the economy, which long-term impacts tax revenue negatively and creates a spiral that is impossible to stop without then major tax increases. Not a penny sales tax, a 5% tax, a 10% tax. Things that people wouldn't really like. Obviously, they never do a 10% tax. They will start taxing a bunch of different things. Oh, we need to do sales. Oh, we need to do VAT. Oh, we need to do another gas tax. All these different things. That's what ends up happening. But if we keep going on this trajectory, we're going to find ourselves in a situation where the only way we can fix our road situation is with major, major tax increases. And roads are a quality of life thing, right? This is a big deal. This isn't a small problem. This isn't like, okay, we can just ignore that. I drive more or less for a living, right? Not exactly. I'm not a chauffeur, but my job involves heavy, heavy driving. So I see these roads. They're not good. They need to be addressed. And even if this tax death spiral somehow were avoided, right? You might be listening to me and you're just like, yeah, there's no tax death spiral. It's not going to happen. Listen, even if that is a fantasy world that doesn't come to fruition, the cost of fixing roads, as I've already said, they go up each year more than our tax revenue is increasing. And so something has to be done. These roads are not going to fix themselves. And the tax revenue currently coming in is not enough. It's just not. This is not a problem that we're just going to fix by saving money. It can only be fixed by spending money. As much as it pains me to say that. And the cost is higher than what the county can currently afford. And I've thought about this a lot. I have thought about this a lot because I do not want to have to spend more money in taxes. It has to happen. I'm sorry. It has to happen. And after much debate, as I've already said, the county agreed, but they're putting this on the ballot. They want the people to agree with them because they don't want the backlash, because they know that there will be backlash if they just put it on here. And here's the interesting thing is that they're holding town halls and getting input from people on what roads are important to them. As soon as people realize that roads that they drive on are going to be fixed, they're suddenly okay with the penny sales tax. They come into those meetings angry. I don't want to pay more taxes. And then they realize that the taxes are actually going to help them and help them in a way that if they just save that money over the course of the year, they wouldn't be helped as much. All of a sudden, the tone changes. And that's a positive. But that shows you, I mean, we're inherently selfish, right? We don't want to spend money. We only want to get money. But In the same token, we want to make sure our tax dollars are spent towards something good and towards something that we'll benefit from. And so this is something that we're finding that people, their tone changes once they realize that they're going to be positively impacted by this bill. And so I will be holding my nose to make another weird sound on here. I'll be holding my nose and voting in favor of the penny sales tax, assuming there are no major changes made to it between now and the election, based on what I've heard thus far. And I don't think that there will be. And I will be voting for candidates who hold to my political values while also holding to a spirit of cooperation, which is necessary for a functioning government in today's climate. And I hope that you guys will too. All right, this has been a long episode, but we covered a lot of ground. I hope you guys liked it. Please, if you did like it, actually physically like it by hitting the like button, hit the subscribe button, rate, review, comment, all those good things. If you're watching on YouTube, listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audio Boom, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, whatever the case may be, please support the show that way. And if you need a realtor in the Greenville area, you've got my contact information because it's in the show notes. Thank you guys. We will talk again next time.